This is Terry Finneman. Today is July 14th, 2020. I am interviewing Cecile Werman for the Community Journalism in Middle America, Challenges and Innovations of COVID-19 Coverage Oral History Project. She is the publisher of the Crosby Journal and Tioga Tribune in North Dakota. Why don't you start out telling us about your journalism career, how long you've worked in journalism, and where you've all worked?
Well, after going to broadcasting school, I got my first job on television in Williston, North Dakota, in 1985. And my whole reason for getting into quote-unquote journalism was that I wanted to be a TV star, frankly. It wasn't so much the journalism that brought me into this career, but once I got into it and realized that my writing skills served me well, and I started getting interested in the issues. From there, yeah, I wanted to be a journalist. So after 6 years in television in Williston, Grand Forks, North Dakota, and Wichita, Kansas, I returned to North Dakota, married a farmer, and ended up working in Williston again, which was an hour away from the farm. But it gave me an opportunity to continue, you know, in the field. And so I worked there doing a talk show and eventually became the news director. And then by then I had three children and I really needed something closer to home. So the Journal, which was my quote unquote home county paper, had always been in, you know, in my focus, always had my eye on that, but I had to wait for somebody to retire until a job would open there. So that took 8 years. I was back in North Dakota for 8 years before the opportunity at the Journal came up. And I became the main reporter for the Journal in Crosby and did that for 13 years before my publisher wanted to retire, so to speak, move on to something different. And then I purchased the papers in 2012.
And what is the circulation of the newspapers?
Well, pre-COVID, we were about 3,700 between the two papers, and now we're down about 300 because we substantially cut our newsstand, and I wouldn't say we've lost subscribers so much as, yeah, mostly newsstand. It just doesn't make sense to have a bunch of stuff sitting around. Plus, when costs are so tight, we're not going to, you know, keep that bubble of extra print to pay to print extra paper. So.
And how many people work in your newsrooms?
Well, when you say newsroom, I guess there's only 2.5 of us that are editorial, so to speak. We have a full-time sports reporter. We have two full-time reporters, and then I also report. So actually, I guess 3.5. And we have two other people, support staff, that do things like circulation and ads.
And then you are fully locally owned, right?
Yes, I'm the sole owner. I'm the president of the corporation.
When did the impact of COVID start with your newspapers?
Well, it's funny. The financial impact was like immediate. The way things hit in the rest of the country at the beginning of March, we sent out our statements at the end of February, and within the first week, it was like, where's the money? Why isn't anybody paying their bills? I mean, I'm really lucky that we have very few people that we carry for any length of time. People are very prompt about paying their bills. You know, we usually send the statements out the end of the month. And by the end of the first week, you know, probably at least a third to, you know, of the money has come in. And I mean, literally there was nothing. So right away, it was clear that people were concerned. You know, there was a lot of uncertainty about what was going to happen next. And so we felt it financially immediately. And then March 10th, we began preparing to work remotely because we could see that that was possibly coming, and got set up with a remote access portal that people could work from home. Our schools didn't resume after spring break, which I believe was around March 20th, and that was the same week that all but my husband and I, we were the only ones in the working in the office. And then Divide County, where Crosby is, we didn't even actually have our first case until March 28th in the county. And to date, that's the only case we've had.
So how else have you adjusted your routines during the pandemic?
Well, early on, around the time of that first case, we could tell that there was, you know, intense interest in the news that we were doing. So we dropped our paywall, and you know, we didn't really determine at the time how long that was going to last or anything, but we just felt that, you know, like a lot of people did all over the country, that we had to make the information available. That story that we did about the first case, in 1 week, drew 2,600 page views, which probably doesn't sound like a lot to people in more populous areas, but there's only 2,500 people in our county. So that month of March that capped off with that story about the first case, COVID case in Divide County, we had over 57,000 unique visitors to our website. So that was a obvious impact. But we've done things like we put a plexiglass shield up at our cash register. You know, we have a sign on the door saying that masks are appreciated but not required. We have had our doors open. They were closed for probably about a month, where we had this is funny, we had our little Santa mailbox that we use at Christmas time to take in letters from Santa. We stripped all the Christmas decorations off of it, and we put that outside the door of the newspaper to receive payments and things, so that people didn't have to come into the office in those early weeks.
Now, as the publisher, in the very early days of the pandemic, there were some concerns from people about if newsprint, you know, if that could spread the virus. I mean, that was quickly debunked, but did that cross your mind as a concern at any point?
Yeah, I think it like you say, it rose up quickly, and then it never gained traction, thank goodness. We do know that the nursing home in Crosby, not just our newspapers, but all mail, they were holding it for 3 days before they would let the residents have it. So we were aware pretty early on that, you know, that there was a concern about this. I guess as far as the newsprint goes, or that end of the operation, I was more concerned, not that they would say we couldn't send paper products, but that our plant would shut down due to illness, because we only have three or four people putting out the newspapers at the plant in Minot, and they do about 8 weekly newspapers. So that was my bigger concern, was that illness was going to cause a problem that would make it impossible for us to get our papers printed.
Do you know what kind of safety regulations they have put in place at the plant?
I don't. I don't think there are any, honestly. I don't think so.
What about for you and your staff, when you go out and have been reporting and shooting, are you wearing masks, or you know, how are you trying to still go out and report safely?
Well, I did tell the staff at one point, and it's funny how this all gets compressed, even such a short time ago, that I try to remember at what point that was. But after we knew we had a case in Divide County, I, you know, quote unquote, declared that anybody that was interviewing anybody, you know, should not be approaching someone without a mask on. And frankly, in that period of time, there was so, yeah, I'm talking, you know, April, early May, there was so little going on anywhere that most of our reporting was occurring on the phone anyway, that I don't think that came into play a lot. All of our city meetings were by Zoom, And so there wasn't a lot of face-to-face contact anyway. So that never really became a huge issue. I was wearing a mask around town when I would go to the post office or the convenience store or the grocery store. I wrote a column about wearing a mask and how important I think that is. We are in a locale where people just aren't buying that. They don't believe it. There's a lot of people who think it's been overblown. My Tioga reporter and I attended a chamber meeting a month ago where 20 people were sitting shoulder to shoulder around a table eating lunch, and he and I were the only ones wearing masks, and I didn't go near that table. I stayed away at a different part of the room because I think that's crazy to be putting yourself in that kind of proximity. But then in late May in Crosby, which is where we've only had one case, like I say, we had a community test where there were 250 people tested and there was not a single positive. At that point, everyone relaxed. Even, you know, nobody had been wearing masks anyway, besides me and a few other people. But after that, even I kind of went, okay, it's not here yet. Maybe I can, you know, relax a little bit. But now we have some things going on in our communities that I wrote a column this week that appears in tomorrow's newspaper that says my mask is going back on.
How have you, going off of that, how have you personally adjusted to being a journalist during the pandemic as far as working home from home more and just trying to juggle this pandemic and being the publisher of two papers?
Well, I mean, I guess the biggest thing is that I recognized early on that I was the leader and that I needed to lead. And I needed to set the tone for the rest of the staff as far as what we were going to do or not do. So I probably, you know, sent my workers home earlier or maybe not when it wasn't at all necessary, but we didn't know that then. And understanding how this virus works, that there's a 2-week lag time, you know, when we had one case, we didn't know if we were going to wake up 3 days later and have 50 or a week later from that and have 150 in a small community. I mean, we just didn't know. So I guess that's been the biggest thing, is just recognizing that, you know, somebody has to make the decision, and I'm going to err on the side of caution. And other than that, I mean, in the 6 weeks from mid-March until the end of May, my husband, who's our main reporter at the Journal, and of course I was reporting a lot then too, we worked 7 days a week, full days, if not longer days. We kind of developed a nightly newscast kind of a routine where he would be listening to Governor Burgum's late afternoon press conference, which often went into the dinner hour. And then as soon as he got off from that, we would cobble together a story real quick, get it up on our web page and share it on Facebook before we would go home. And we were doing that every night around 6 o'clock, even 6:30. And it was like, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm in television again. It was crazy because we have not done a lot of daily reporting. We are a weekly newspaper. We do, you know, share breaking stories when necessary, but that was an intense period of daily reporting and daily posting and breaking news, and people were really responding to that. We knew that it was very vital what we were doing.
Yeah, so going off that, talk just a little bit more about how your newsroom strategy has changed as far as print, online, and social.
Well, I think the biggest thing is when you have news, it's just natural to share it. You know, in a small town in rural northwestern North Dakota, there aren't a lot of things that cry out to be shared, you know, 2 days after you just put the paper out. So shifting to a daily reporting model, I mean, I think we proved, I'm very proud of how we did that and that we were able to do that and do it so well. But I also think that there's not a lot of, not necessarily a lot of lessons that we can take from it, because, you know, people aren't going to respond to, oh, hey, you know, the pool's having hot dogs this afternoon, like they are going to respond to, oh, by the way, there's a COVID case down the road, you know. So I'm not sure where we go with that as far as trying to integrate that in the future, but at least we know that we are capable of doing that. And I mean, in general, it has made us more likely and open to saying, you know, let's not hold this for the paper. Let's put this up. And, you know, that the worry always was, well, we're going to give away the whole paper. Why would anyone buy the paper? But the fact is that social media is so, you know, scattered, and you, just because you've shared something on Facebook on Thursday doesn't mean that everybody saw it and you can't print it in your paper again the next week. I mean, so.
How have you tried to balance pandemic coverage while also still covering other things?
It hasn't been too difficult, because in the first intense 6 week period, like I said, there wasn't really much else going on. I mean, it was all COVID all the time because everything was closed. Kids were not in school. Every event was canceled. You know, it was all we had to report on. So there wasn't a requirement to really balance it. Since things have sort of, opened up a little, I guess the one really noticeable thing that I've tried to keep my eye on is that, you know, when you don't have people out doing things, you don't have pictures of people in your paper. And that becomes very, it really lacks humanity when you don't have pictures of people's faces in your newspaper. So we made a concerted effort to have, you know, that one human story that, you know, somehow we got close enough to someone that we could get a face in the paper. So that's been important. And as things have opened up, you know, we've had so many cancellation stories, so many, okay, they're doing this event, but they're doing it differently stories. It is kind of still all COVID all the time, but we cover what we need to, you know, I guess I haven't felt a pressure that we needed to balance, you know, really balance anything.
So you've kind of just covered this, but talk a little bit more about the biggest stories you've covered related to the pandemic. I remember reading your story about your one case. Talk a little bit more about what it was like to do that interview.
Well, that was, you know, those are the times when, in a way, you're thankful for how close you are to your community, and in another way, you wish you weren't. but we were so fortunate that the gal who ended up coming home from a trip to Las Vegas with COVID was so open and so willing to talk. And the thing is, when you already have, you know, it's not like she was my best friend, but, you know, when you already have a passing acquaintance with someone, like, you know, she's on my Facebook feed, to message them and say, oh, hey, you know, I heard you have COVID. Would you want to do a story for the paper? I mean, people can react either very positively to that or feel like you're taking advantage of your acquaintance. And so you just never can really be sure what you're going to get. She responded so positively. She did everything right. She wanted to assure the community that she had done everything in her power not to expose anyone else. And the amount of interest in that story, that's the one that I mentioned earlier that got 26,000 page views. I mean, that is unheard of in our universe. So that was really an important story for people to read, that, you know, that she was okay and that they weren't so much at risk. And was really happy to do that. We learned that there was a Divide County graduate who now lives in Minnesota, who had signed up to go work in the hospitals in New York City. And we were able to do a three-part series with her where, you know, the first part, I think, kind of delved into why she wanted to do this. I mean, she went and left her own children at home and left her husband to go work in a place, you know, where people are dying of a disease no one really understands. And a gal who frequently does freelance work for us was a classmate of hers. And so she made the connection with her and did a fabulous series that really brought home that New York experience, you know, because we didn't have cases here, but we needed to understand the wider world and to see it through the eyes of someone who's from here. That always makes an impact. So I think that was really important. We also have a lot of expat Divide Countyans living all over the country. And from people I'm friends with on Facebook, I learned that, you know, we had a whole bunch of subscribers in California who were dealing with, you know, their early, very early shutdown that they had on the West Coast. And so I spent a Saturday afternoon just calling all of those people and putting together a story. You know, people who graduated everywhere from like 1962 up to, you know, the 90s or 2000s, and talked to all these people who still, you know, are from here. People know them. They still have family here, and they're experiencing what's going on the West Coast. And then, you know, just all the business changes, impacts. Some of the earliest reporting that we really did was, I mean, we were out of toilet paper long before we had a case of COVID. You look back on that now, and it just seems like, did that really happen? Did we really do a story about and take a picture of an empty shelf where the toilet paper normally is at the grocery store? but it's funny, you know, having to prepare to talk about our COVID response, you know, and going back and looking over those papers, it just seems in my mind like one really long day. And I look at all those stories and I just go, wow, how did we do all of this? But that's what we're here for. I felt the same way when on September 11th, 2001, when we were able to bring home the tragedy of the World Trade Center disaster to folks here and connect it to people who had, you know, been there, been around it, and that kind of thing. This type of historic coverage gives us an opportunity to be the best that we can be and to show why newspapers are so important, why journalism is so important, you know, that this is indeed the first draft of history. And, you know, I'm just so thankful that we have the skills, and so we kind of get to show off our skills at a time when, you know, people are experiencing a lot of bad things. But, you know, this is why we do this, is for these times.
So let's return to talking about the financials of your newspaper and advertisers during this time, and in addition to this, also talk about your request to City Hall.
Well, so like I said earlier, we knew immediately, uh-oh, we're in trouble. And of course, February, March is normally our fat time because it's subscription time and people are, you know, it's when we get a whole bunch of subscription money in. And so a lot of years, the money we collect in those 2 months is the money that carries us through a lot of the year. And so we're also at a very low ebb at the end of February. So to have something of, you know, gigantic proportions that's never happened before come at the same time as our main renewal period for subscriptions, and then not have advertisers pay their February bill because this is suddenly happening and nobody knows what's happening with money and how bad they're going to get and all that. We were in very dire straits immediately in early March, and you know, I didn't know how we were gonna, at that point, I didn't know how we were gonna make it, you know, to make the next payroll. you know, by the end of March, if something didn't happen, if people didn't start paying their bill. So I had earlier worked on a proposal to the Tioga City Commission at the suggestion of someone connected with their Economic Development Council to say, you know, why don't you come up with a program that would, you know, stimulate your business, but also prove, you know, so to speak, prove the value of advertising. So I kind of had a ready-made proposal that wasn't designed for COVID, but then when COVID hit, it was like, okay, well, I could adapt this to say to the city council, you know, I know that advertisers can't afford to advertise because they're not even able to pay for the ads they ran in February. Now it's March and we're running out of gas to operate on and they don't have money to advertise. So we, you know, I applied for a grant for $25,000, which was what I called an ad credit program, where the grant came to us, but then we doled it out to people as they purchased advertising. So essentially their advertising cost was paid by the Economic Development Fund, which is funded by a 1% city sales tax for economic development, jobs retention. What better way, you know, to having been, I actually was Crosby's economic development director for a couple of years before I worked for the newspaper. So I was fortunate to kind of have, you know, a good understanding of what the aims of that program was and what the goals were that I could make that pitch. However, my initial pitch was met very harshly. And this was in the midst of all this crazy reporting and uncertainty and, you know, working our butts off, and went to the city council and they basically said, yeah, that, what makes you so special? You know, everybody's hurting. And I'm basically telling them, look, you're not going to have a newspaper in another month if we don't figure something out. And they didn't care. They didn't care enough to do anything. So that stung and was really disheartening at a time when we were working so hard. However, because I had sounded the alarm, and I guess sometimes you just have to be that that guinea pig that goes in and takes all the beating so that other people can get something. So out of my request, which was earlier than anyone else had put up any kind of a red flag about a financial difficulty, the sales tax board designed a grant program for all of the businesses in Crosby, and we were able to apply for that. And all of those businesses, I think there was 28 of them, got a $5,000 grant from the sales tax. And then I went to Tioga and I pitched the same program and got $10,000 to extend ad credits to local businesses. So in the end, it was positive, but it was a very uncomfortable process. At the same time, we're begging donations on our webpage and people are sending them. I mean, all told, I think we collected just under $5,000 in small donations from people just off of our website, basically saying, kind of modeled after, if you've seen what The Guardian does, you know, they don't require you to have a subscription, but at the end of all of their stories, they say, if you want to support what we do, then please give what you can. And so we added a message like that at the bottom of all of our stories and had a button on our webpage, and people did respond to that. So that helped a lot too.
Did you apply for any paycheck protection money?
Yes, we that wasn't an easy decision either, because I mean, I'm pretty assured now that it's going to be forgiven. In fact, I heard there's even some proposal that anyone under $150,000, they're just going to automatically forgive it without even providing any documentation, which is crazy. But I mean, there's so much of this paperwork and documentation that, you know, they're never going to get out from under it if they don't do something like that. But at the time the program started, it was not assured that newspapers and or any business could truly get it forgiven. I mean, I was not up for taking out essentially $55,000 to $60,000 in a loan because how was I ever going to pay that back? And so I hesitated, but we did get it after some, you know, the guidance just kept trickling out and it was a different story every time you heard about it. But finally I was just like, you know, we'll take this now and worry about it later, because if we don't take it, we're not going to be here. So we took it. And now it turned out to be a good thing. And I think it's pretty assured that it's going to be forgiven. So
we're now in July. How is your advertising revenue now? Is it coming back?
It's hard to say, because where we're at right now, along with these donations and these grants from the sales tax funds, we also got a major grant from the Andrus Trust here in North Dakota to do some subscription underwriting to cover some actual costs of printing and postage, and to explore the possibility of going nonprofit. So that's another big chunk of money that we got. We got the $5,000 Google grant, and we got a Koch Pointer Fellowship for our Tioga reporter, which is paying 60% of his salary for a year. So we've had in the last couple months this flood of money coming. I mean, this is crazy, because at the beginning of May, I didn't know how we were going to survive. And now there's all this money in the bank, which is great, but it's making it really challenging to figure out, okay, how much of this money would we have gotten anyway? How many of these ads, you know, are truly grant ads that we wouldn't have had otherwise? And so it's just complicating the whole financial picture. My general sense is that advertising isn't bad, but this, in the next few weeks, we'll be done with all of those grant ads, and that's when we're going to really see where we're at. So we're kind of in a bubble right now where we're comfortable, but I'm worried that it's just, you know, that cushion has got to last us for quite a long time.
You mentioned earlier cutting back your newsstand. Did you cut back on any pages or anything like that as well?
Yeah, we actually did. So normally the Journal is typically a 12-page paper, and the Tribune is a 10 to 12-page paper. You know, sometimes either one of them could be 14, but I'd say 12 is the average. They were both down at one point to 8 pages. And it made sense for a couple of different reasons. One whole page was our correspondent news, which is all the small town news of who had coffee with who and who went to visit. And, you know, there was none of that news. So it was, and that whole type of reporting has really dwindled, you know, in the recent years. So it was fairly simple to say, okay, we're dropping the neighbor's news. That's, you know, it's something we had to pay for. We had to pay people to do it. It wasn't really, didn't have much value of content, and it was a way to save a page. And then we have had so much discussion, particularly in the Tioga community, about the commentary page in recent years, with the, you know, increasing political divide in the country. The way we feel it in our communities is that it just so happens that those of us who write commentary for the newspaper tend to be more liberal than most of our readers. And they don't want to hear it. I mean, they've made it very clear that they're not interested in reading an alternate viewpoint. And so I've resisted for a long, long time. And I wouldn't say that I still have column. I've had a column, you know, somebody's had a column every week, but we no longer have a commentary page that is completely opinion. We've really cut way, way back on that, because, you know, people don't want it, and we can save the cost of that page. So Tioga went down to we both went down to 8 pages, but I think the journal's only been 8 pages once. We're more often 10 at both, but the Tribune's a little thinner sometimes, so they've been bouncing between 8 and 10 instead of 10 to 12.
So with all of this that we've just talked about, how do you see the business model for the industry changing as a result of this pandemic?
I wish I knew. You know, I've been studying up and continue to spend whatever amount of time I can keeping my ear to the ground as far as what's going on in the industry with smaller papers. And the thing that I keep hearing over and over again is nonprofit. And so I, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we actually wrote into one of the grants that we applied for $10,000 to explore the feasibility of becoming a nonprofit. I don't know that that's the answer. I mean, that's why we're going to study it. I kind of believe that's probably not going to work for us, only because of the numbers. If you look at what, you know, in a county of 2,500 people, if we have to replace the amount of income that we, you know, had been counting on advertising for, you know, you'd be asking people to pay about $200 a year for a weekly paper, and I'm not sure there'd be that many people lining up to do that. So, then again, you know, we've got to look at it. I think more realistically, what's going to happen is that we are going to have to find a way to keep doing what we do to the best that we can with fewer people. And it wouldn't be that we would be cutting. I mean, how do you cut, you know, a town from one reporter to half? You can't do that. We would keep everything in editorial and condense our jobs. You know, like maybe this sounds crazy, but maybe the sports reporter becomes the expert on circulation management, and maybe the publisher has to do the bookkeeping instead of having a bookkeeper. And we all know how to lay out pages, and we all know how to, you know, manipulate InDesign well enough to design ads. It's kind of, I see us all having to become, it's an all hands on deck sort of thing where there's going to be fewer people, but we're all going to have our fingers in everything just to get the job done.
So kind of combining a couple things here. As you know, newspapers have spent years debating print versus online and when cutbacks to print should happen. And so taking into consideration that and how people are publishing online more to get news out during this time, with that in mind, as well as how do you think the pandemic is changing journalism as an industry?
Well, there's a couple of things. At one point, I was thinking, and it gets back to your newsprint question earlier, when I considered the possibility of our plant guys all getting sick and not being able to publish the newspaper, I thought, oh, well, we'll just do everything online. And then I really started thinking about what that meant, and there's some real problems with that, and it's something that even I think that the North Dakota Newspaper Association needs to consider addressing with the legislature. You know, we all get a not a huge amount of money, but a significant amount of money from legal notice publication. And the fact is, in North Dakota, if you're not printing a printed product, you don't qualify to be an official county newspaper. So that there's a problem there. I mean, I can see that it certainly makes sense to move to an online delivery method, but by the same token, right now, the biggest share of our subscribers are people who still like to touch a paper. They, you know, they also do the online, but they still want to receive that paper in the mail. So, you know, it's not as simple as just saying, well, okay, we're just going to, you know, it's not like a daily that can say we're going to cut back to 3 days a week or 2 days a week or whatever. We only have one paper a week. And if we stop publishing it, we lose, you know, we potentially lose our legal notice income, and we potentially lose that tangible physical connection that so many people have to our product. So it's not something that we can, it's not very likely to happen for those reasons that we can just abandon print. Unless the post office shuts down, which is, oh, wow, let's have another stressor on this whole situation. There was another part of your question there, but oh, how is journalism, or how has the pandemic changed journalism? Yeah. I don't see that, I don't really see that it has, because, you know, it's all about telling people stories, and this is certainly a story to tell. We might have to find different ways to connect with people and protect ourselves, you know, like with masks or doing, you know, more interviews over the internet or, you know, whatever, but it's still the passing of information from person to person and us putting it out there. That, however that makes sense to happen, that's what we will do.
So besides the spike in some web traffic, what changes, if any, have you noticed with your reader base during the pandemic? You mentioned more donations, right?
Right. And because, you know, because we not only had the button on the website, but I actually wrote a column about, you know, what are you going to do when your newspaper's no longer here? And people really responded to that. So that was heartening. But it's frustrating because, okay, we just had, right now in Tioga, we're kind of heading into, I know it's not a second wave, it's still the same wave, but for us, it's a second heightening of COVID activity. Just this week, we have had a spike of COVID cases actually connected to out-of-state workers who are doing a major project in Tioga, where there's a large gas plant. And so they've brought in hundreds of workers from out of state to work in a place where heretofore we have had very few COVID cases, and now suddenly Williston has had 67 cases since June 25th. That's 3/4 of the total case count they've had the entire pandemic. So we're heading into this into this high an intense amount of interest from people. So we posted a story a couple days ago about what we knew about these cases in Tioga. And somebody on Facebook says, hey, since this is a public health issue, will you drop your paywall so we can read it? All of this is a roundabout way of saying that people want the information we have, but they want it for free. And it's really frustrating. I first answered the person and said, you know, I don't know that we can drop the paywall on a single article, but, you know, if you really want to read it, it only costs $1.99. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and I thought, you know, that's always been our policy, that if it's, you know, critical news that people need, we are going to make it available. So yes, we can drop the paywall on a single article, and I did it. So what I have noticed is, I mean, when 27,000 people read a single story about a COVID patient, or people are clamoring for news about this outbreak in Tioga, clearly there's a whole universe of people right in our communities who want what we have to offer, but they are not willing to pay for it. And so it's great, you know, now our web advertisers are a significant portion of our income. And during the month that we had all that traffic when our paywall was down, our web advertisers got a lot of clicks. And it was really cool to be able to tell them, you know, that they got 5 times as many clicks on their ad as they did in a normal month. That was really cool. But that doesn't erase, you know, that there's not a clear enough correlation between making your news free and having a few advertisers benefit from that, that we could turn that into some kind of a model that, okay, we're just going to give the news away now. So one of the ways I'm attacking that is this, I have $25,000 from a grant to underwrite subscriptions to 900 families of school children in four different towns in our coverage area, and I may be naive, but if we can actually get the newspaper in the hands of all those people, I am hoping that, you know, not only will we have a nice bump to our circulation for a year, but we'll also have converted, let's hope, some portion of those people to people who realize that news is worth paying for when the free subscription is up.
How has the pandemic influenced you personally?
Personally, it's caused me to make some of my loved ones a little crazy. My husband puts up with me watching CNN all night, almost, and it's not like I'm watching it intently, but I mean, it's like it's on all the time because I'm very tuned into what's going on around the rest of the country. And I think that I have to say, I really think that's informed some of the decisions I've made here locally, even though we're not in such a heightened pandemic situation. It's made me aware of where we could be if we don't take the necessary precautions. My children range in age from 22 to 29, and they believe that this whole thing is a hoax and that they don't need to wear a mask and that it's been being overblown, that the media is making more out of this than it is. And so they're really tired of hearing about this from me. And I'm to the point where it's like, okay, well, if you're not going to protect yourself, then I'm not going to be able to see my grandchildren because they live in Williston and Watford City, which are places that have a lot more COVID activity than we do here. And I also am a caregiver for my mom, who is 77 and would be, you know, very hard hit if she were to be exposed. And so I have to protect her. So, I guess I am just determined. I am not going to be that person that you see in every disaster movie that you go, oh, you know, don't go in the closet, you know, don't open the garage door, or don't go in the basement. I mean, these things that to me it seems so obvious that there are real risks involved in this pandemic, and there are some very simple things that you can do to protect yourself from it. And I will be damned if I'm going to be that person who just, you know, stuck my head in the sand and pretended like it was going to go away. But that doesn't mean that the people around me appreciate hearing that. And in the end, I mean, I can protect myself all I want, but if all the people around me, you know, don't, then, you know, I'm so floored that our country is this ignorant and selfish and just in denial about the potential of this thing to kill people we love and to overwhelm our health system and to ruin our economy. And they won't do something as simple as protecting themselves and each other by wearing a mask. I just can't believe it.
What do you want readers to know about journalism right now?
Oh, I don't know. In regard to COVID or just about, that's a tough question. What do I want readers to know? I guess I want readers to know that, you know, we do what we do because we feel a calling and a responsibility to give people the information they need to have in order to live their lives. And in this case, with the pandemic, it's literally to save their life. And I want people to know that that's a sincere desire on the part of every journalist to help people get the information they need to have a better life. And if I'm getting kind of wound up because it's hard being also under so much pressure right now because of the political divide in having journalists motivations question. You know, I'm not in this to get anybody reelected or not reelected. I'm in this because I want to survive. I want my children to survive. I want my town to survive. And I care. And I think, I don't think that's a message that many people hear or think of when they consider the media or the press, that we are individual people living in a community charged with helping everyone else get the knowledge they need to have. And that's, I mean, that's a high calling in my book.
What do you want journalists 100 years from now who may be covering a new pandemic? What do you want them to know?
I want them to know that what they do every day matters. It can feel, especially when you're under attack for various reasons, you know, the reader's mad about something you wrote, or you made a mistake and spelled somebody's name wrong and they get bent out of shape. You know, those little things, they sting, but in the larger picture of what we do in trying to give people the information they need, this is really important work, and details are very important. The example I would give for that is that back in the big flu pandemic, you know, in 1917, 1918, we had reporting in the journal about that. And I actually went back and scanned a number of articles and wrote a story about all of the things that people were doing, like not going to the movies and wearing masks and washing hands, and churches weren't in session and school was shut down. And I mean, we've been through this before, and there's a trail in every small town newspaper that you can probably go back to 1917 and 1918 and see how your community handled it then. So imagine, you know, for this other historic pandemic, that your own grandchildren will be able to go back and see and understand through your eyes what it was like. That knowledge of knowing where we've been and hopefully learning lessons about where we've been, that is just so vital and valuable to the future people that I don't ever want to forget that. In a way, I mean, yes, I'm writing for the readers today, but I am also writing for my grandchildren.
Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about?
No. I've probably about talked myself out. I guess honestly, I don't know where this is going. Anybody who does is probably crazy. Here in my own little corner of the world, we're, like I said, we're ramping up to, I'm afraid, another very intense period of weeks with this outbreak in Tioga. And it's very possible that our little communities are shortly going to be filled with many more COVID cases. And I don't think I was necessarily scared before. I mean, I was leery of all this, but now when I've heard all the stories about what, you know, seeing all the things that have happened in New York and Arizona and Florida and all in Italy, I mean, it's like, I'm worried. I'm worried that we are only just in the beginning of this, and we are in for a very, very long haul.
Okay, this is the conclusion of this oral history.